this world is constantly attempting to provoke a response to its seemingly endless stimuli. That's how it's all set up. It's all react to this, judge that, enjoy this, hate that. You know, it's wanting us to react and you know, get caught in the phenomena.
I was gonna say it's like almost a consistent loop of peace suffering, peace suffering.
This is the Beware How show, mystic philosophy made practical. There are many paths up the mountain, and we're just pointing at a few of them. I'm Bob Peck, speaking with Scott Stanley, Ryan Padgett, and Melina Kiriaki. We are conscious creatives and formerly closeted mystics trying to unpack the inaccessible. According to the mystics, the truth cannot be spoken, but we'll try to talk about it anyway. Today is October 4th. And we are demystifying mystic philosophy.
Ryan's on a trip, and we have no guests today, but the three of us will be going through, Bob, Scott, and Melina, will be going through mystic philosophy, kind of common misconceptions about what it is, aka that it's not magic, basically. Really traversing the internal path. Mysticism and mystic philosophy is just associated with the experiential, the internal, the personal, kind of oppositionally to the institutional. And not enough people know that. So we want to really cover that aspect today. I do want to hit too on their kind of unique conceptualization of the divine, particularly like the immanent and the transcendent, which we'll get into. Maybe touch on ecstatic states and definitely go through kind of mystic groups within each world religion. It was such a relief, maybe that's the right word, to learn about them in you know, comparative religion school at the University of Texas. I just didn't really know at the time that every faith tradition has institutions and mystics. And we're in kind of a unique, say, like the overview intro here is like, it's such a cool time in world history where, you know, in the past they were persecuted, typically. The institutions had such control over the religious systems kind of across the world and in every one of these cultural traditions that the mystics kind of had to operate almost in secret, you know, the secret teachings and the mystery schools and things like that. And, you know, this past century or so is the flowering of this formerly kind of hidden knowledge that, granted, it's not for everyone. I think that's part of the beauty and maybe allure to it, but it's exciting that we can study all these different books and study all these different teachings and texts. You know, free of our own volition, without any fear of persecution by, you know, the Inquisition and angry preachers and
angry men with power.
Angry men with power of all kinds. So they still exist, but it's harder for them to persecute us these days. So just, you know, that's kind of my context for today. I'll also add that it is St. Francis's feast day. My in-laws are Catholic, and my mother-in-law said, tomorrow's St. Francis's feast day. I said, I have to mention that on the show because Francis of Assisi is an incredible mystic. He is, you know, really to me, one of the kind of exemplary people, exemplary Christians of like the true teaching. And he's really not too known in Protestant American Christian, you know, stuff. Like, he's more known by Catholicism and kind of by the world mystics. The world mystics kind of consider him in their fold, but the Protestants don't really care. The Protestants are just Jesus, Paul. It's about it, you know, kind of modern day preachers and maybe a couple of American ministers of American history, but he's great. And there are a couple of quotes from him. He says, "Preach the gospel at all times, and when necessary, use words." action, beautiful. Right? Practice.
Just taking a pause there.
yeah.
Loving that.
He's great. He was focused on feeding the poor and caring for animals. He's the patron saint of animals within Catholicism. Mm-hmm. But he was a beggar. He was actually born a rich prince, kind of similar to, or not a prince, but a rich aristocratic young boy, and went to war and kind of had his revelatory experience, I think, on the battlefield or near the battlefield, and realized this wasn't for him, that he was a peaceful man, and kind of relinquished his wealth, similarly to the Buddha, you know, in that same kind of narrative formula of disillusioned rich man that kind of gives it all up. And the Franciscan friars are what he created, this order of monks, and they're still active today. He was alive in 1200s in Italy, and he was great. He said, "If God can work through me, he can work through anyone." So,
great.
Shout out to Francisco.
Beautiful shout out.
Yeah, didn't he admonish the Pope for like his riches, or was that someone else?
It sounds like him, frankly. I'm not sure exactly.
Okay.
There's a great story of him where he, in Italy, in that era, 13th century Italy, they were already kind of missing the point. I mean, I think Jesus' teaching got, you know, check out episode 4, by the way, for the full examination of our true feelings about the teachings of Jesus. But, you know, he got misread pretty soon. But like 1200 years later, like there's very rich Italian kind of aristocratic communities. St. Francis walked into this church one time, and it was like Christmas or a Christmas ceremony, and it had gold plated everything. The pews were full of like immaculately dressed kind of pompous Italian aristocrats, very like showy, you know, which I think everyone is familiar of, like that aspect of religiosity. And he got so disgusted by the extravagance that he left the service and brought back in dozens of barn animals in an attempt to remind them of the true nature of Jesus's birth. He, you know, Jesus being born in a manger was symbolic of his, rejection of materialism, I guess, really. And it created quite the scene, as you can imagine, that first shocked and angered the churchgoers. And then he got up and preached to them about Jesus's embrace of the poor and his kind of non-attachment to wealth and things like that. And so, he was quite the guy. Big fan of him. And it's ironic because, like, now we have, like, prosperity theology preachers and, like, private jet kind of Christian, you know. It's like, he would say the same thing to them, you know. It's like, it just keeps happening. Which is really, frankly, a pretty good segue into... you know, kind of what is mysticism and debunking mystic philosophy, you know, and you guys jump in. This is basically based on a Medium article that I've written. It's pretty long. It's 18 minutes right now. Might get longer, but, you know, it's a college course of subject. So, you know, forgive me that... you know, it's hard to cover everything in a short article, but thanks for that. But
especially when it's not focused on in academia, you know?
Right.
Yeah, you're covering a lot of stuff.
Yeah, too. I mean, not necessarily. Yeah.
So considering how much you cover.
Yeah, it's very, very quick run through of the high level. So
I loved it.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. I'm not too concerned about, you know, the length, but I'll blab on and on. and it's just the beginning. So it's based on my article, and Scott and Melina, feel free to jump in and help make this stuff even more digestible and practical and all that. But yeah, I mean, I think basically the first point is this world is constantly attempting to provoke a response to its seemingly endless stimuli. That's how it's all set up. It's all react to this, judge that, enjoy this, hate that. You know, it's wanting us to react and you know, get caught in the phenomena.
I was going to say, it's like almost a consistent loop of peace, suffering. And you keep on feeling a little inch of the peace from, like you're saying, react to this, love this, all of these external things. And so much compassion for the human being, because that's all we knew, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, growing up in this world, just trying to find external validation. Yeah. So it's such a beautiful concept to understand, you know, the value of looking within and understanding that you're not going to find that, and you're going to consistently stay in this suffering, peace loop until you kind of wake up and pull yourself out of it.
Totally.
And connect back.
Well said. Yeah, absolutely. It's Sisyphus is an image that I reference. Yeah. He's a, you know, Greek myth of like ancient boulder going up the hill, and like he pushes it and almost gets it, and falls down, almost gets it, and he's like condemned to eternity to do that, and it's pretty freaking symbolic of our own tendencies to, you know, never quite become liberated on the external. Like, you know, it's, you have to redirect that. And I'm so grateful, you know, I think there's just so many, there's just human beings. I mean, that's what kind of this religious history study showed me, was like, there are just human beings that have transcended this, that, you know, that pain, that suffering of the human, you know, seeking outward. They redirect it in, and, you know, they either, there's multiple methods, you know, and that's what we'll talk about today. There's through the heart, there's through the mind, there's through service, there's through a variety of ways, but it is possible. And that's very beautiful and encouraging to us, you know, asylum residents. Here,
you know. Asylum residents. I was wondering, before we get too deep into it, just as a listener, because myself, I mean, I didn't know what I was feeling as, you know, wanting to turn inward and wanting to learn more about detaching from external validation. You know, I didn't know mystic was kind of the all-encompassing definition of this kind of lifestyle, as well as just being. So I'd love for us just to flat out just talk about the definition of mystics and mysticism, just to kind of get it out there.
Thanks
for that. I mean, I think experiential is pretty key. And, you know, like there's a Rumi quote. Sometimes when people ask me about what mysticism is or what the mystic philosophy is, there's a Rumi quote. He says, "I looked for the divine in churches, synagogues, and mosques, and I found it in my heart." You know, this kind of internal awareness and experience, you know, that I do think those religious, dogmatic rituals, institutional things can engender for people. You know, I think from time to time there are positive, you know, to my religious pals and listeners, like, you know, that the reason why the community ritual exists is because it's trying to engender that experience and create that experience for people. You know, the problem is the hierarchicalness of it, and I think, you know, hypocrisy of like kind of posturizing or postulating, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, no, there's some hypocritical religious folk, and that's a huge turnoff. Posturing, I guess, is maybe it. And yeah, so I think it's just, you know, the mystic is the external world does not bring lasting peace. And, you know, the redirecting that inward. Carl Jung, who was a famous psychotherapist of the 20th century, who was kind of Freud's protege, but he, you know, he went a bit more mystical in his later years and talked a lot about the collective unconscious and, you know, archetypes and myth, and Jung was extremely critical thinker, and he said, "He who looks outside dreams, he who looks inside awakens."
Beautiful.
You know, there's this theme, right? Yeah, of just redirecting from the external.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And to your last point,
that's my definition.
Almost the institutional side, like you said, it can have value and that it can point to the internal. From my view, it almost inevitably can become a conundrum because it's an outer source pointing to the internal, and so it like starts to fall on itself in a way. So it's like necessary a lot of times because sometimes people need an external source to point inwards first so that they can figure out, oh wait, I got to come back here, but then it can create problems if it becomes the source instead of the sign pointer to the internal source.
But, yeah, so true. I think idol worship is kind of what that, like in the Old Testament, which is taken literally a lot, which it shouldn't be. It's poetic and, you know, it's the world of the mystic also is figurative language and reading into like symbolism and, you know, imagery and metaphor. And you know, the idol worship thing of like, a lot of modern day kind of Abrahamic religions read that, and by Abrahamic, I mean Islam, Christian, Judaism, the children of Abraham, is those, the big three. They typically read into idol worship as being condemning of using, like, for example, like in Hinduism, using like a Ganesha, like an elephant, a little statue as like the representation of the divine, like, you know, a fiery evangelical would condemn that and say no idol worship. However, in their church they have crucifixes up. You know, they're using symbols as well to connect that to the divine. And you know, I think the true read on like condemning idol worship is exactly what you just said. Like all like David Hoffmeister, one of the Course in Miracles teachers, says something like the entire cosmos is an idol, which is like kind of lurching us forward a bit conceptually into the mystic episode, but all of form is actually you know, a placeholder or you know, something to look through to get to the transcendental. And I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, cool. Sounds good.
That's the end of the episode now, I guess. Yeah.
But I do think it is also really beautiful to point out that identifying with mystic philosophy and mysticism is also the acceptance of all religion, all ideas as one, and not to put it simply, because I know that's very, there's so many deep, deep pieces of it, but all are the same. We're all one. We all, there's a foundational truth to all that connects us back to, you know, ourselves and being all the same. So just making that point as well.
Evelyn Underhill was a Christian writer. She was unbelievable. She wrote in the beginning of the 1900s. And I cite her book, Mysticism. It did a lot, I think, for the mystic tradition from like a scholarly point of view, which we'll talk about at the end of kind of the modern day reads on this stuff. But she says, quote, "Where the philosopher guesses and argues, the mystic lives and looks and speaks. Consequently, the disconcerting language of firsthand experience, not the neat dialectic of the schools. Hence, whilst the absolute of the metaphysicians remains a diagram, impersonal and unattainable, the absolute of the mystics is lovable, attainable, alive." Juxtaposing between kind of the headiness of like intellectualizing this stuff and like seeing that, you know, I think, you know, the connective string between the pearls is mystic read. And you know, every, to your point, every faith tradition has institutional and mystical, and it's also called exoteric and esoteric. I mean, they're kind of
totally
oppositional, like semantics. Exo meaning institutional, esso meaning personal and internal. There's another great quote from Meister Eckhart, who was a medieval Christian, whom the great Eckhart Tolle took his name from. Not everyone knows that, so let me just clarify. Eckhart Tolle's great. He took his name to honor the great Meister Eckhart from a millennia ago. Meister Eckhart.
Thank you for sharing that. I did not know that. So the whole time I was reading about Eckhart, I was just having I was thinking in my mind, oh, same as Eckhart Tolle.
Yeah.
You know, I just didn't know that they're directly that. Okay, thank you for that.
Yeah, Meister Eckhart was so great, and Eckhart Tolle. Mm-hmm. Is tributing him. Meister Eckhart says, theologians may quarrel, but the mystics of the world speak the same language. Mm-hmm. Of the heart, of truth, the underlying connective force. I do want to talk a little bit about George Harrison, because he's such a great example of this to me. And he's extreme inspo, just like the Western creative, I think, just being a huge Beatles fan and being a huge fan of his music. Most people are familiar with his explorations into Indian philosophy. And he met Ravi Shankar, who was a famous sitar player in India, but also a philosopher. You know, Ravi was pretty sophisticated with this stuff. And, you know, George, you know, basically said no one really impressed him. You know, they met everybody. They being a Beatle in the 60s, like they met the presidents, you know, they met actors and everyone. And he said the first person who really impressed me was Ravi. And it was because he wasn't trying to. You know, I think everybody was kind of trying to be showy and like be this image and the nervousness of meeting a Beatle and stuff like that. But Ravi was just kind of like, hey, if you really want to do some exploration. Yeah. It was tangible to him. And he says, George, he revolutionized, he almost single-handedly is responsible for incorporating the sitar and like Indian music into the West. He says, quote, Ravi and the sitar was kind of like an excuse trying to find this connection. I read stuff by various holy men and swamis and went around and looked for them. Ravi and his brother gave me a lot of books by some wise men, and one of the books was by Swami Vivekananda, who said, if there's a God, you must see him, and if there's a soul, we must perceive it. Otherwise, it's better not to believe. It's better to be an outspoken atheist than a hypocrite, end quote. And he says, and after all my life, they tried to bring me up Catholic. They told you just to believe what they're telling you, not to have the direct experience. And so, you know, he says, for me, going to India and hearing someone say, no, you can't believe anything until you've had direct perception of it. I thought, wow, fantastic. At last, I found somebody who makes some sense.
That's
George.
Great.
And
admiration
for the
East. He's like
us
in that we all grew up in a culture that very much emphasizes like evangelists and missionaries. And there's something a lot more like almost political about that kind of approach, where it's very much you're winning converts and growing your team, whereas like you said, the mystic side has no interest in any of that, and it's more about like you yourself experience this, and you know, if you haven't experienced it, don't worry about it, it's not for you, but when you do and you're ready, it will be there for you. And so that's like that's a huge shift from the culture that he grew up in and that we grew up in too.
Yeah, it's so true. It's also interesting because I think like zooming out a little bit, like, you know, why is this stuff not as well known? And I think it's because the mystics aren't very good at organizing, you know, where that's,
they need some marketing.
It's also the beauty of it too. Yeah,
like, you know, there's a couple of megaphones here and there, you know, of people that wrote about this stuff and just devoted their life to it. And a lot of the swamis, and we'll talk a lot about the emissaries at the end here, but it's kind of antithetical to like creating an organization, having people, you know, convert other people. Joseph Campbell, who's another great scholar who was into mysticism, he wrote Hero of a Thousand Faces about kind of the monomyth among ancient cultures being really similar, and he was kind of a Jungian.
And George Lucas read
follower
his stuff
of his. And then George Lucas sci-fi. Wrote Star Wars from Hero of a Thousand Faces. Absolutely. Luke Skywalker was the cover of a later edition, because Campbell, George Lucas was a student of his, in college and, you know, kind of ripped him. Not, you know, lovingly, obviously, but he definitely, Joseph Campbell purposely put Luke on the cover of a later edition. But yeah, he said, he talked about, there's a really great interview with him. It's like the last, I think the last year of his life with Bill Moyer is called, it's called The Power of Myth, but it's amazing. And he talks about how when he went to India, he said these gurus just, you know, they're just hanging out. They're just sitting there kind of like, it's the opposite of the preacher on the curb yelling at people for going to hell. Like he said, you know, you would go up to these Hindu teachers and they would say, do you have a question? You know, as opposed to you need to do that. You should, you know, it was just like, if you have an inquiry, then let's sit with it and unravel it. It's just so opposite.
Yeah, it's like, let's see where your mind is at right now instead of, hey, get your mind here where mind is, where prescriptive. My mind is at.
Yes. Exactly. Pushing, you know, really pushing. And there's a real beauty in the flow of, you know, the mystic path. And the East and the West, I mean, I think it's a bit reductive too to say like, all of the East is mystical and all of the West is institutional, because that's not certainly not quite right either. There, you know, again, every faith tradition has both of those interplays. It's just more broadly, like the contemplative side of things is just a fuller part of the practice in the East, in Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and so on. Whereas Sikhism, Jainism, whereas in the Abrahamics, it's almost kind of, you know, it's there, but it's only with St. Francis, really. It's only with Meister Eckhart. It's only with a couple of the breakout, you know, kind of saints that were so almost pure in their devotion, is probably how I would describe it, even though that's kind of a loaded way to phrase it. But they pushed through based on their own, like, sincerity, I think. Like, Francis was just so sincere in living the letter of Christ's teaching that he realized that the oneness, you know, he broke through the veil by his own heart and by his own sincerity. And there was also even Jules Evans is a philosopher who talks a lot about the perennial philosophy and mysticism. And he was talking about how they in Europe a few hundred years ago, they closed all of these different monasteries and nunneries. And it was such a step back, kind of almost like a de-contemplative, you know, de-evolution of the contemplative aspect of Christianity that was, you know, pretty powerful. Like Saint Teresa of Avila, for example, was a famous nun who wrote the Inner Fortress or the Inner Castle about kind of the mystical progression and, you know, the mystic tradition within Christianity comes from mostly from monks and nuns. And so when we closed all those due to political reasons and so on, like it just, we kind of lost a lot of that great stuff. The Cloud of Unknowing, which is in the intro, was an anonymous text by, which is cool, by the way, just an anonymous author. They were just like, no, I'm not even attached to my identity to be, you know, like, I like that. That vibe. But the Cloud of Unknowing is a famous one that's you know, beautiful and referenced by kind of modern day mystics, and it came out of the monastic tradition of the medieval times. So there's a lot of that.
Yeah, like just the history of Christianity kind of happened to be this way, but like there were early mystics and that could have played out differently had they not been like persecuted and killed. And so it's 100%. Like, I always think about that it's like, it's we almost had something like that and that drove the Western culture, but.
And it makes you also think that it was like the ego of humans that got in the way, which brought on the disappearance of it and the persecution of them. You know what I mean? And so it's like, I can't help
but wonder, grab.
What would the Western life be like had that not happened? Just to your point, Scott, of what you just said, like. Now I'm thinking.
Yeah, alternate history. It would have been, could have been different.
So unfortunate.
Yeah. And I didn't know that.
But it also brought about.
Till I was older.
The way of things. I don't know. Anyway, no, I agree. I honor that. you know, basically what you guys are referring to is the Gnostics and the Gnostic Christians, the Desert Fathers, you know, when Jesus was traveling and speaking there to Jews, because he was a Jew, there was a pretty wide spectrum of, it's called like sectarian divisions, or like S-E-C-T-S, different Jewish sects that were interpreting him in different ways. And for example, like the Gnostics are a bit, they're actually not so black and white. There's kind of the Valentinian Gnostics. There's the Marcion Gnostics, the Marcionites. There's a few different flavors based on individual teachers. So we won't go into that. I still want to have like a specific to Gnosticism episode in the future, and like go in on Gospel of Thomas, and Ryan will be there for that because he's a big fan of that book. But yeah, I think, you know, the Gnostic Jews and Gnostic Christians were one of those sects. The Essenes were another sect that you might have heard of. They were kind of the cliff dwellers outside of this city of Jerusalem. They lived in the caves and the cliffs and kind of had their own culture and community, but they were more apocalyptic. The Romans got rid of them by the blade, and so yeah, there was a lot of kind of turmoil and political vying for power back then, not too dissimilar to now. I'm seeing a theme here of the human tendency to you know, vie for power and get lost in it all and let the ego take over. But yeah, the Gnostics were certainly worth, you know, they're very much worth investigating and trying to understand, because they did exhibit this mystical quality to their reads of Jesus, that are, you know, fairly absent, or at least they're fairly harder to discern in the Gospels, in the New Testament. There's a couple of little, you know, seeds here and there that, especially even like yogis, like Yogananda wrote voluminously about the Bible. And he was just like, when you're almost like liberated, you kind of see it in everything, and you're able to pull this kind of stuff out of that. So, you know, it is in the New Testament, but particularly these Gnostic Gospels, so they're called, were found recently. They were found 70 freaking years ago, in Nag Hammadi, which is in Egypt. You know, essentially these guys were persecuted. They were killed by the, you know, more powerful church fathers. Irenaeus was one of them. Athanasius was another of them. Those guys were persecuting Marcion and Valentinian, and they, you know, basically these guys buried these books, their leather codices. They're actually leather-bound books. You can see pictures of them online, that are about almost 100 different editions of different books. Gospel of Thomas is the most famous one, because it's considered to be the earliest, and it's very, very interesting. It's, some scholars date it as early as Mark, which is the first gospel. So it's definitely as early as the other four, and it is amazing. We knew it existed. I'll just read a quote for in a second, but we knew it existed because of Irenaeus and Athanasius writing letters. Like, we have those guys' correspondence to each other going, you know, the Gospel of Thomas is crazy, the da-da-da is crazy. So, you know, we knew they existed because these guys talked about them, but we didn't have them until the 20th century, 2,000 years later. And so, saying 77 from the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says, "Split a piece of wood and I am there. Lift up the stone and you'll find me there." Very unique among, you know, the red letters of the bigger book. You know, he definitely exemplifies this, pantheism, meaning God in everything. God in all things, which is certainly at odds with, you know, institutional Christianity, institutional Abrahamics. And pantheism has overlap into kind of broader mystic philosophy. I wouldn't it's not quite black and white, but there's pantheistic elements to the mystic philosophy. And so anyway, Gospel of Thomas, the Gnostics, you know, they really were exemplifying this aspect a long time ago that unfortunately Christianity really was pretty efficient at, you know, withholding from the world.
Mm. Yeah, the Gnostics liked talking about the illusion too, right, of reality, and that there was this kind of despotic illusion happening around us that we had to pierce through via internal reflection and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. The illusion is definitely a key component of the mystic philosophy, I think.
Yeah.
You know, generally speaking, I more preferred the term the dream or using the imagery of a dream because I think what happens now in like New Age mystic thing is like, oh, it's all an illusion, and that, you know, it's kind of become cliche in this like almost like as a rationalization for apathy. Like it's all an illusion, and that to me is a misread on the mystical experience and the mystic philosophy, which is if you're one with everything, then therefore you are connected to the suffering as well as the bliss. You know, you play your role. You're adding to the harmony. You're interested in working towards the happiness of all beings and the liberation of all beings, and that ain't apathy.
Right.
And so it's very dismissive to say like the illusion, or like it's all illusion. So, you know, it's tricky. And I think that's a good segue too into the imminent and the transcendent, which we just kind of have to bring that up obligatorily, even though I don't feel super authoritative in outlining all of it. But, you know, there's an idea within, big shout out, by the way, History of Mysticism by Swami Abhayananda. Melina and I have been reading the last past week. It's really great. The subtitle is The Unchanging Testament. He's really good and kind of going through the history of the different schools and the development of, and he talks about, he's a convert. He's a Hindu convert, the author, but he talks a lot about how, for example, quote, when we examine the mythologies of these early civilizations, especially those myths which describe the origin of the cosmos, we find a curious similarity in the religious symbols used by widely separated cultures. In almost every instance, we may discover the legend of an original father god whose first thought or word, symbolized in the form of a mother goddess, is said to have given birth to all creation. In nearly every part of the globe, these two have appeared. Albeit with many names, he, the father god, has been called, I'm not going to pronounce all these because they're going to be wrong, but An, Apsu, Huan, Prajapati, Purusha, Yahweh, El, Tim, Atmu, Ra, Shiva, Brahman, Zeus, Vishnu, Ahura Mazda, the Tao, among a few others. And that masculine energy, that divine kind of father creator, is the absolute stillness, the pure consciousness, the unclouded mind, the unmanifest ground who exists as the substratum upon which all this universe is projected. Likewise, in nearly every recorded mythology, we find the mother goddess. She has been called Inanna, Isis, Shakti, Kali, Devi, Durga, Maya, Sibyl, Athena, Tara, Sophia, Prakriti, and many, many, many other names as well. So there's kind of this imminent and transcendent. Like there's this dual nature, really, even though we're talking a little bit about non-dualism, this dual nature of reality as kind of transcendent of all of it, transcendent beyond this world, while simultaneously linked into the imminent manifestation, the present experience of our existence, intertwined, and kind of the mystic is unifying those two planes in the mystical experience.
That was really, I like had to close my eyes while you were explaining that so I could really picture everything you were saying. That was a great way of explaining it.
Shout out to Swami Abhayananda. I'm just reading him. That was mostly him. But, you know, yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very mm-hmm. useful concept because, you know, it explains so much about, you know, really just the monolithic, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of the thin reed, frankly, yeah. of like Michelangelo's old Italian man up on the cloud. Like, it's such a overly cartoonish simplification of, you know, a really grander cosmic scene that's going on.
Definitely.
He says, let's see, he says, quote, "The individual who contacts through prayer or deep meditation that universal consciousness experiences it as his or her own identity. He or she realizes in those few moments that he or she is indeed nothing else but that one being manifest in a singular individual form, and that all this universe is the manifestation of that one being combined of the mother and the father, flowing forth from it a wave of love streams from a loving heart." Really great. I mean, the mystics, just read them. You know, this is kind of like a commercial for, you know, the History of Mysticism book. And Aldous Huxley, by the way, the great Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World, is his most famous novel. He also wrote Doors of Perception about his mescaline experience in the psychedelic, kind of early psychedelic literature. He wrote a book called The Perennial Philosophy. And you kind of can't bring this stuff up without mentioning that book. That is really a foundational text. I think he published it in 1944, on you know, this idea that, wow, what Lao Tzu is saying in Taoism sounds a lot like what Shankara is saying in Advaita Vedanta, which sounds a lot like what Meister Eckhart is saying in contemplative Christianity, which sounds a lot like da-da-da. And, you know, almost, I think 60 to 70% of the book actually is just quotations. You know, he has little commentaries, but then he's really just stacking different philosophers and different philosophical systems in order to demonstrate their, you know, conceptual overlap.
Yeah. He was just writing all that out while World War II was raging in the background.
Yeah, with their liberating
didn't think about
the camps while he's publishing, you know, which is also autobiography. He was writing, Yogananda was writing autobiography during World War II.
Wow. It's
pretty crazy.
Wow. That's a really good thing to call out.
Powerful moments of time. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What else? So conceptualizing the divine, immanent, transcendent. Before we jump into like specific groups, because I do want to just kind of give like little example of each of these traditions so we're more specific.
Totally.
A little bit about the ecstatic. I don't really have much written out here to prepare, but you know, that excerpt kind of touched on it, which is you know, experiential seems to be a part of this mystic experience. It's not something that's intellectualized, even though we're talking about it and using words to describe it. This feeling of connecting with, you know, the transcendental comes through deep meditation and prayer. You know, it comes through Mircea Eliade used the term rupture of planes, you know, this kind of consciousness portal of pushing through. It's also called like breaking the veil, you know, you might have heard that term. That is the actual circumstance that takes place in kind of affirming this stuff. Right, it's not just something you write about. Talk about it actually has to be the felt experience, you know, I think psychedelia plays a part in like giving a glimpse of that to people, and like certainly the shamanic traditions of the native spirituality kind of across the globe utilized plants and they utilized different fungi to traverse those planes of consciousness. And explore other ways of seeing reality. And I think part of what that does, you know, in the breaking the veil experience, I haven't really had, you know, what these guys and gals describe. I have had very powerful, like, heart chakra feelings of, like, bliss and love and connectivity. And, like, I talk about that in the chakras article. Like, like a couple of fleeting glimpses of that kind of is like all I needed to like want to read every freaking book about this, you know, mm-hmm. like my humble accomplishments on the path really like, you know, keep you going on it. It makes you want to go
the experience further.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yo, let's keep pushing through is really the feeling. But
it's also the beauty, you know, behind it as well, because you can't manipulate it. You can't intellectualize it. You can't force it. It's mm-hmm. purely experiential, and it's much, much stronger than anything you can imagine intellectualizing, you know?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's also an idea about, like, undoing is a big part of the mystic path, you know, mystic
philosophy. Do you talk more about that? What do you mean?
Well, like, or, like, undoing or, like, unlearning. Or also like remembering.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Like, yep. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like to your point of like the intellectualizing, like the analytical mind, you know, kind of are the altar of the modern era is kind mm-hmm. of how some like philosophers describe it. Like mm-hmm. we're so overly rational because of, I think a few centuries ago, the church was too powerful mm-hmm. and those religious institutions were so powerful that when the pendulum swung, you know, philosophically to the secular scientists and philosophers, it had some ego in it, mm-hmm. like in a reactive kind of oppositional energy that neglected the intuitive. You know, the rational mind and like scientists are the new priests, you know, some mm-hmm. people say that, kind of use that terminology. And it's great. It's useful. And we talk about this almost every episode, right? The rational mind and the intuitive mind, the interplay between those two. But, you know, by reducing the rational minds, you know, it's called, the Buddhists call it monkey mind, you know, reducing that analytical through this practice, through spiritual techniques and contemplative practices, you can start to hear, you know, you're undoing that in order to listen, in order to be more receptive intuitively to things beyond sense. You know, it's kind of it's beyond sense perception. Our sense perception, you know, science proves that there's more to the visual spectrum than our eyes can perceive. You know, we have little kind of like affirmations almost that the sense world ain't it, or at least it's not the full picture. And that's a big part of it too, you know, is getting beyond that sense perception of getting caught in the worldly phenomena. Does that
say that 100%? Yep, 100% on the same page as you now. And I think it's just, at least for me, it brings up a lot of compassion for the human condition.
Yeah,
because you know, the to stuckness. An extent, you know, yeah. I mean. It just makes you kind of pull down your walls because you're like, what else were we supposed to do? We thought that it was just all about like, we didn't know. It was like a lack of, it's like the unlearning piece. That's also really beautiful. That's why I wanted you to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. No, yeah. Thanks for drilling it. Let me drill in on that. Which is a good, you know, I think I like this idea of like segueing into some of these groups from some of these concepts, like
definitely
reading a little bit more about Kabbalah. It's like pronounced Kabbalah or Kabbalah within Judaism. It, you know, the Kabbalists are basically the esoterics and the mystics of, you know, kind of more fundamental Jewish religion. The foundational text of Kabbalah is the Zohar. The Zohar is very good. It is very, very interesting, and it is ultimately it's a metaphysical commentary of the Torah, which is the five books of Moses. It's kind of most of the Old Testament, is what they call it in Christianity. The Zohar kind of changes the game for a lot of different Jewish religiosity. For example, really this idea of like the unspeakableness, like it's called ineffability. Of the divine, like it's preposterous to think that you could sum up the divine in words and concepts. Like, so the best word for it is the unspeakable or the ineffable. It's called Ein Sof, the nameless, unending infinity. Check out Kabbalah and the Zohar, especially like Jewish friends. You know, it's like, it's if you were raised in a tradition that you're interested in, but maybe you're stagnating a little bit, like, check out the contemplative side of your own faith tradition or any other one, you know, that you don't have to be.
Totally.
But it can it might reinvigorate your own path and your own pursuits, you know, depending on. But again, many paths, one summit.
Exactly. Super liberating to know as well that we just don't know anything at all, which is...
yeah, absolutely.
It's just so much more attractive to learn. Like, I don't have to know everything, you know, I can just, you know.
And that's what the, one of the big...
It's so at odds with culture.
Yeah, and it's one of the big things that, you know, the quote-unquote father of, what is it, father of Western thought, Socrates, that was like his claim to fame, was that the oracle told him he was the smartest man in the world because he was the only one who knew he didn't know anything. So that's like a very like mystic little seed that got planted in like the Athenian Renaissance, which was like, you know, and I wanted to bring that up too, like, cause you were mentioning the, you know, the like secular science movement that separated from the church. Mm-hmm. And like, there are certain parallels where like, there's like mystic seeds planted within that movement, like where you're leaving the authority, you can find the truth out for yourself. You know, the difference being like using empirical evidence versus just like internal
hugely
experience.
Socratic.
But but just the idea that you can, you know, you're trying to like sort through these falsehoods that were given to us by an authority figure and all that. But yeah, that's the one that always stuck with me, is that Socrates was like, you know, and like the Plato's cave allegory came from that idea that like, you know, we're very much living in an you know, dreamlike illusory situation, and that, you know, you're going to have to like break through that to get at some truth. So that's like a theme that I love.
Yeah. Gurdjieff, who is a modern mystic, he said, you can't, the first step to exiting the prison is seeing your chains. You know, you have to notice you're handcuffed before you can escape.
Say that again. I love that.
That's a paraphrase. But yeah, he said, it's something like that. He said the first step to escaping prison is noticing you're chained.
Right.
You know, and so many people, I think, that aren't, you know, and that sounds judgmental. Like, as soon as you like make the broader brushstroke of like, you know, just society's just a bunch of sheep that doesn't see it. Like, that doesn't feel right either to make that accusation. But sometimes, objectively, like, I think a lot of people don't, or at least lack some sense of self-awareness about this greater possibility, this greater potential within themselves, you know. That's why this stuff is so powerful.
I think to your point, though, Bob, it's not, it's, I think you're including yourself in that. So I think even though we have the self-awareness right here, right now, we're also humans. I'm speaking for myself that I would fall into it. Yeah, yeah. And so I think like almost when you're saying a judgmental thing, I don't think you sounded judgmental. I think it's just self-aware that we're, all three of us as well, are going to continue to fall into those chains of not being aware that we're in them. And that's just part of being in this world. So it's that much more powerful, the amount of times that we recognize the chains, again, just to kind of go along with that point in that example.
Yeah, well said. That's so true. I think it's typically incremental, you know, like from like a evolution of consciousness aspect, like there are the Buddha and, you know, and Sri Ramana Maharshi is a great example. And Eckhart Tolle actually had the park bench incident famously. You know, there are a few seekers that just like light bulb turns on and like their life is divided into two halves where they were deluded and then liberated. And that does happen. I think that really does exist, because read them and just get lost in how brilliant the wisdom is. Whereas I think most of us, certainly for me, you know, it's been a gradual increase of positive qualities and a reducing of negative qualities, you know, over time. Like, I'm not perfect. I have plenty of flaws. and my transparency and vulnerability about them has helped lessen them, you know, a bit. But it is gradual. And so, you know, I think to your point too, Melina, like self-compassion, self-forgiveness, mm-hmm. like, you know, kind of that like reassurance is very useful. Be gentle with yourself.
And I think also just to touch back on Tolly, because he did, when he kind of talks about the park bench and then he went through his light bulb moment. And I think, and I'm, don't quote me on this, but I believe in the power of now, he also discusses how he went through months of just pure bliss. Mm. And in those months of pure bliss, it was all experiential. And while the light bulb didn't turn off by any means, he definitely makes it known to the reader in the power of now that he came back to society, you know, it was living right. in with that dual, you know, like falling into being a human while also having this awareness. So I do think being humble about holding the both of them, to your point, self-compassion of being a human is really important as well.
Yeah, that's so true. I think that's definitely a big part too of like the transcended and the imminent, you know,
mm-hmm. it's
like,
right.
you it's... can't be too off and lost outside of the planes of like this conscious realm. You gotta drink coffee and pay your mortgage, or that's just me, but you gotta have worldly obligations. Mm-hmm. And also Sri Ramana Maharshi, who I talk about pretty often, he was incredible, Advaita guru, which we'll probably jump into here in a minute, but he never prescribed swamis or sadhus to go off and live in the mountains. And he was kind of really, I mean, he was the silent saint. His main teaching was silence. And it was described that his, like, verbal teachings were secondary and only for those who couldn't get the first one. You know, that's how emphatic he was on the contemplative side of things. However, even he never said, you know, abandon your family, go off into the mountains, you know, you have my blessing, da-da-da. Like, he never suggested that. So it's a big misinterpretation, I think, if we're, you know, carrying the kind of debunking theme. That's a theme I see a lot about people thinking about spirituality and, you know, the kind of carelessness maybe of mystic, you know, how that can be seen from society is like just being, again, apathetic or like dismissive. And I really want
to,
you know, draw attention to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Vivekananda.
Sufism is another really good sect. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, just to
before Vivekananda was brutal.
Yeah, about the pragmatic. Staying on the Advaita Vedanta. Yeah, I was just listening to him about audiobook version of him writing about that same thing, that, you know, certain people are in different phases and they have different duties, and like part of their journey is to like fulfill, if your duty is as a, you know, a householder, you know, maintaining, you know, your family and stuff, and he's like, you don't run away from that, stay in that and like learn, you know, your practice through that. And so I didn't know that until recently either, that these supposedly, you know, like distant ascetic, you know, figures were actually telling people, no, like engage in your life and just realize and remember that it's that it is, you know, that dream, but that you have to, your path is through
as you're going through your world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's an interesting distinction.
Yeah. I might even say that there's almost like a, you know, I think Jeremy Hoffeld actually talked about that, like how karma, the term karma, we think it means like retribution.
Yeah. You know, it means punishment,
but it's like, but no, it's like the cosmic unfolding. It means more like curriculum. Right, like everything presented to you is exactly designed for your own benefit or your own capacity to transcend. And like, I do have to disclaimer that, like in 2020 America, that can be misread by, you know, the socioeconomic issues that we have, cultural, racial, so on. Like, I don't, you know, I have to caution that viewpoint by, you know, acknowledging differences within experience and like severity and like, you know, not to be too privilegey, you know, it's like, there's Syrian refugees that are escaping war torn, you know, parts of the world that can't sit with the book and, you know, like there's rougher situations out there. And like, I don't want to be like,
right. I've never liked the phrase everything happens for a reason. Like I've never liked that, and it's because it makes it feel like if you tell that to someone after something terrible has happened to them, it's like a terrible thing to say. And it doesn't even get at the real truth of the matter, because it's not as if, you know, it's like this happened to you for this reason because you deserve it, or, you know, it's that like punishment mentality. And it's not about that. Like you said, it's about just like, this is the state of things. They're unfolding the way they will unfold. And like, there's not a ton we can do about just it other than moving through that process, you know? And like, I don't know how else to put, I don't know what short little phrase would
explain that. No, well. You're right. The growth from trauma. Yeah. I think the growth from trauma comes from your own realization over time. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, it's not going to be something where you're like, and that's something my wife's taught me. Like, I'm very megaphone, as you guys know. And like, my wife's the opposite. She's very like, everyone's doing their own thing. They're all on their own path. And like, she very yin and yangs me back into reality, because like, she had a really rough, basically like health problems as a kid and medical issues. And it was very difficult for her at the time. And guess what? It was a portal. Because she came out the other end like this emboldened, you know, incredibly strong woman that, you know, wouldn't be where she is without what she went through. And like, you know, we've all had rough moments in our lives that, you know, can really mold you into who you are. And, you know, you can really grow from them. And so it's like, that's your own realization to have. But it's not, again, it kind of doesn't really work as like a prescriptive reactive way but to kind look of at it.
Using Mel, your wife, you know, as that kind of using that example of her life and what she went through, kind of going to what Scott was saying about everything happens for a reason, I think it was a really good point to make. You know, probably at the time when she was going through the medical, before kind of the light at the end of the tunnel, the portal that she went through of who she is today, I'm curious, like, would Mel think, you know, everything, I'm happy that that happened to me because everything happens for a reason, but meaning it in the perspective of the journey of learning, you know, the experience she had.
I think at that period of time, you don't have that sentiment about it, right?
Right,
you
know, exactly.
When you're going through it, it's, you don't want to hear that because it's not, it's, you're in pain.
She didn't deserve, you know? Exactly. It's not like she deserved, exactly.
Yeah, it's, you're not open to the larger teaching at that moment of the trauma. Mm-hmm. And so we should in the same way, like the spiritual, you know, the philosophers, we can't be like, well, da da da, like, no, that every person has to go through that and have that realization. So
that's how
I would acknowledge that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd maybe the only other thing I'd say is like, it's not like the bad thing itself that like should be the emphasis. It's your transcendence of it and like your reaction to it and like your own choice to move past it. And that's like the power in the situation. Not that that bad thing had to happen to you. It's just that you saw
it's a very important point. And spirituality gets a bad, you know, flavor from people sometimes because of that. Again, that kind of misread on apathy and like, and also though, like if this stuff is really all about compassion and love, which I think it is, it's not being very loving and very compassionate to tell someone that, you know, because it doesn't acknowledge their pain and acknowledge
the really real feelings they're going through. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. True compassion is, you know, not coming from that objective cosmic voice. And I think Ram Dass even makes the distinction like chakrically. Maybe this is another episode, but he says like, you know, if you're in your heart chakra, you know, and you see someone who's hungry, you're like, you do anything to feed them. You'll cook the food, you'll give them the money to, you know, go obtain it. But he says, if you're in your third eye chakra, you know, you might come from that view and say, oh, well, that person's hungry because they need to go through, you know, you kind of are able to zoom out and see the cosmic unfolding a bit more clear, but it's different. It's a different energy than the compassionate heart that is wanting to feed and eliminate the suffering of the person. So, you know, many paths, many ways up.
I cut you off and you were going to Sufism.
Let me just
kind
of run through the last sex
yeah,
here.
Because
yeah, we're going to Sufism. Yeah, that's okay. That's part of conversations. I want to go through these mystic groups and then just touch on like what New Age is kind of on the way out here. But basically, yeah, Sufism, you might have heard of the Sufis. Rumi is the most famous. Hafiz is pretty famous too. Rumi's read cross religion. He's read in yoga studios now, which is has no relation doctrinally to like Hinduism and yoga practice. In fact, Islam and Hinduism ain't that close historically. And so it's kind of, you know, he's a beautiful bridge, I guess, in that sense, across folks that have had disagreements over the years. But but yeah, Sufis are the mystic Muslims, and they're not quite their own sect, whereas like Gnosticism is like their own sect, Kabbalah is like its own sect. Sufism, they can be, but there's also Sufis both within Sunni and Shia. They can kind of be within the orthodoxy or not, so they're a little bit different. They're also sometimes associated, speaking of experience, with the whirling dervishes. Might have heard that term or seen these guys and gals spinning around.
Great dancers.
With their robes, beautiful dancers. And they're just mimicking kind of the intoxication of the spiritual experience. Sufi comes from the Arabic word tasawuf, meaning to dress in wool, referring to the woolen garments of early Islamic ascetics. I think I'm stumbling over my words because I'm not an Arabic speaker, and there is an Arabic speaker on the panel.
Yes, I would say you're doing great. I mean, it's definitely that dialect of Arabic is not the Arabic I know.
So. Oh, okay.
There are many dialects, many different versions. So yeah, continue. You're doing great.
Yeah, it's also like I think I asked you too about the Sufis one time, Melina being an Arabic speaker, and like I'm pretty sure. Well, like Rumi is from ancient Persia, which is Iraq, and I believe that he might have written in Urdu or Iranian. Yeah, there's. It's very like kind of like white American. Like misstep to be like, oh yeah, Arabic is what all Muslims speak. Like, no, obviously not. There's a billion Muslims, but it's just a very broad spectrum of culture. So acknowledging that, honoring that. They're big. The Sufis are big on like the heart path. Actually, they talk about a lot about admonishing one's own worldly desires in place of love for the beloved. To the Sufi, God is almost this recipient of, like, romantic love isn't it. It's beyond that, but it's like love and beloved, basically. It's even, there's a genre of poetry called ghazal. The ghazal genre is like, it's like love poems, but it's basically to the divine. Hafiz writes, love is the funeral pyre where I've laid my living body. All the false notions of myself that once caused fear, pain, have turned to ash as I neared God. What has risen from the tangled web of thought and sinew now shines with jubilation through the eyes of angels and screams from the guts of infinite existence itself. Love is the funeral pyre where the heart must lay its body.
Ego death.
Ego death. Yeah. Exactly. It's all the same, guys. That's just a subtitle. Let's
it's
see.
So
yeah.
Powerful, though.
There's a lot of great Rumi stuff, too, but, you know, maybe we'll be not cliche and just not read Rumi in a mystic podcast episode because he's so ubiquitous. But he's great. He's really great. He also writes a lot about the dream and seeing out of the dream. I think he says, he has that famous quote, I don't even have this written down, but I've seen it so much. He says, like, you're not the drop in the universe, you're the entire universe in the drop, or you're not the drop in the ocean, you're the entire ocean in a drop. Like the mystics also kind of play on common cultural phrases because they're just flipping consciousness. And speaking of flipping consciousness, Zen Buddhists, which we cover in the mindful, you know, Zen could be considered mystic within Buddhism. you know, there's definitely traditional Buddhism, Theravada, mm-hmm. and within my Mahayana also, there's very much like ritualistic and like prayer 108 times in this meditation and like sit for this amount of time and so on. And like, but Zen is, what happened was, we explained this on the show, but what happened was Zen was taken to China and Japan by, actually we know who the person was. His name's Bodhidharma. He's kind of a mythical figure, but he looked Western, actually. Yeah,
I was wondering about that.
He looked kind of like a white guy and like had a beard. Mm-hmm. And I think he had red hair. He was like kind of an Irishy looking guy. But anyway, he came from India. Buddha was Indian. And, but when you think of Buddhism, you almost think Japan, China. So it really just did well as it went eastward. And what happened was when it hit China, Buddhism and Taoism kind of merged a little bit. And that's what Zen is. Zen is really kind of the child of traditional Indian Buddhism and Chinese Taoism. So Zen is really great. And you probably heard of it. It's a pretty commonly used term, but but it's really good. There's an Alan Watts quote, who was a great kind of British Zen teacher. He says, "Zen does not confuse spirituality with thinking about God while one is peeling potatoes. Zen spirituality is just to peel the potatoes."
Presence, awareness.
Presence, extreme presence. And, you know, different than the heart of the Sufis, you know. I think the Sufis are like, they see God in everything and love of the beloved and so on. And, like, that's kind of the Sufi heart path. Well, Zen's a little different. Even though it's mystical, it's still reducing emphasis on institutional, I think, is why I would consider it within mystics. And Thomas Merton wrote a book called Mystics and Zen Masters, and it's really good. And so he is probably the main reason why I would consider Zen within mystic traditions. Bodhidharma sounds like a non-dualist. He says, "People of this world are deluded. They're always longing for something, always, in a word, seeking. But the wise wake up. They choose reason over custom. They fix their minds on the sublime and let their bodies change with the seasons. All phenomena are empty. They contain nothing worth desiring." Mm-hmm. He was brutal. I mean, there's some Eastern teachers that just, why would they hold anything back?
Exactly. You know?
There's nothing to hold.
That's interesting. The phrase "reason over custom" is interesting. Presence, to me.
Yeah.
It jumped out to me as very Renaissancean of him. It's like leave the authority behind. No custom. Just find your internal reason or experience or whatever.
True. Yeah.
Yeah. Reason over custom. Personal process over communal dogma and ritual, you know?
Yeah.
Huge. Let's see. Last one really is Advaita Vedanta, and then I want to just kind of run through New Age. I know we're
going over a little
bit. It's all good. We're having a lovely little chat.
I'm very curious about Advaita. I'm like, is it Advaita Vedanta? Vedanta.
Advaita.
Advaita. Oh my goodness.
Advaita.
Advaita Vedanta. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I would love to. This is I know least about this, so I'm really excited to dive in.
Amazing. Well, I am probably conceptually closest to Advaita Vedanta. Maybe we do a whole one because I kind of want to like touch on this and touch on mystic or New Age. But Advaita is incredible. It's sometimes it's called the jewel of Indian philosophy. You know, Hinduism, look, there's no Hinduism proper. It is such a vast tradition. You know, Christians have a couple of different denominations and so on. That's not true, they have hundreds, but Hinduism is like amplified variety. And also they have this inclusive aspect, which we've talked about, where it's like everybody's the mask of the one anyway, so why not just have another one? You know, Hinduism is very, very broad spectrum, and within that, Vedanta is one of the main schools. Vedanta just means of the Vedas, which are, you know, these ancient texts. The Vedas are some of the oldest writings of the human civilization. They're as old as the Old Testament, basically. It's like the Vedas and the Torah are like some of the oldest books we have, or oldest writings we have. And so, yeah, the Vedanta, the highest purpose of the Vedas, and within Vedanta is Advaita. So Advaita Vedanta is a type of Vedanta, which is a type of Hinduism. Yeah, super useful. The Upanishads are a few centuries later. They're another group of texts, but they're very good. And the Bhagavad Gita is kind of like the New Testament of Hinduism, in that it's a conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. And so Advaita kind of draws from the Vedas, the Upanishads, and the Gita. A few others, but those are the main ones. Yeah, it's very good. Advaita is non-dual, which means not two. And it's, you know, kind of, again, to the illusion piece from earlier, to the dream. According to the Advaitists, let's see, I actually wrote this down. Non-duality, meaning not two, is the idea that the Atman, individual soul, and Brahman, formless divinity, are one and the same. According to Advaitists, or Advaitins, I think either, Advaitists, they are separate terms in concept only. Ultimately, there's no distinction. I think kind of similar to the immanent transcendent idea from earlier. Like, those are two separate concepts, but ultimately, it's one, you know? It's like,
yeah, let's like we be have clear two here. Words, but they're describing the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. There is real no, there's no real separation. Mm-hmm. Shankaracharya, Adi Shankara, was really, he refined Advaita. Some of Advaita, actually, because he was in 800 CE or 700 CE, 8th century, he actually drew a little bit from Buddha, who came a few centuries before, right? So Buddha was reforming Hinduism. Well, so was Shankara. Shankara was reforming Hinduism, you know, about 1,000 years later, 700 plus 300, something like that, several centuries later. And Shankara, he wrote a lot. He wrote kind of commentaries on those older scriptures, but he really made it what it is. He revitalized the monastic tradition in India. He talked, you know, endlessly about the unity of Atman and Brahman. He says, quote, "Once we become conscious, even dimly, of the Atman, the reality within us, the world takes on a very different aspect. It is no longer a court of justice, but a kind of gymnasium. Good and evil, pain and pleasure still exist, but they seem more like the ropes and vaulting horses and parallel bars, which can be used to make our bodies strong. Maya is no longer an endlessly revolving wheel of pain and pleasure, but a ladder which can be climbed to consciousness of the reality." He's great. He's really good. And yeah, go ahead.
That's just, it's just a fascinating distinction of like the, he's looking at the same big karmic wheel or whatever you want to call it, but he's saying there's like maybe a different purpose to it than just, you know, endless punishment, rebirth, pain, pleasure. There's a reason it's here, and there's a reason we're here in it, and that reason is to like move through it and transcend out of it, which is a big change.
Yeah, really great. You know, flipping consciousness. Advaita is so cool, and it's called like Neo Advaita now, like new pref, the pre. What's the word for that type of the word?
Precursor. Prefix. Oh.
Neo Advaita. Yeah, it's basically like white dudes who read Sri Ramana in America, aka me. And Neo Advaita is interesting. There's a lot of like, and I think this is a good tie-in to New Age, but it's kind of like spiritually, like the cool kids in spiritual discussions are like, those Neo Advaitins. Misreading it because it's really intellectually tough stuff, you know. I think just non-duality it just doesn't really make sense rationally. I mean, that's mm-hmm. kind of the whole point. It's like the conceptual isn't, it's too flimsy to process anyway. There was a couple of gurus. I talked about Sri Ramana Maharshi. Sri Ramana was a 20th century guru of Advaita. He was born in 1879. He died in 1950. And he basically lived his whole life on this hill in Arunachala for decades. And he is kind of the premier Advaitin guru. He's worth like reading everything he said. It's very like, you don't have to do anything. Like as soon as you think you have to do something, you're trapped, you're caught, you're stuck by thinking that you have to get out of it. I mean, it's like, it's tough. He says, quote, happiness is your nature. It is not wrong to desire it. What's wrong is seeking it outside when it's inside. Mystic theme here. He says, your duty is to be and not to be this or that. I am that I am sums up the whole truth. The method, he's talking about the Bible. The method is summed up in the words, be still. What does stillness mean? It means destroy yourself, because any form or shape is the cause for trouble. Give up the notion that I am so-and-so. All that is required to realize the self is to be still. What can be easier than that? Mm-hmm. I mean, almost like a little sassy, you know?
A little sassy.
Which is so great.
He's like, he knows how infuriating it'll impatient. Be to some people.
Yeah. Yeah, almost impatient with us. Let's see. Just a couple. I read his the other day. Let what comes come. Let what goes go. Find out what remains. Oh, this is good. Then we'll go on to New Age. He says, realization is not acquisition of anything new, nor is it a new faculty. It is only removal of all camouflage.
I love that. It is literally just removing all the clutter. Mm.
Yeah,
it's already there.
Yeah, yeah, and undoing.
And even the word camouflage is useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because he's
exactly.
implying that it's a, a mimicry. Yeah, he's very good. Sri Ramana. And then there's this other guy. We talked about this in the defining non-dual, I think. But Sri Ramana and then Nisargadatta. And Nisargadatta Maharaj is even more impatient with his disciples. They're both really great. And Nisargadatta was 60s, 70s. I Am That is the book about him. And so anyway, I think it sounds like we should just do a whole Advaita and just go off. But but yeah, let me just jump into New Age real quick before we finish up. This is kind of going to be one of the longer episodes. But hey, Mystic Philosophy, it's far-reaching.
There's a lot to unpack there. So
there's a lot to unpack. I know. And I have a conclusive point here. So if you're still with us... This is going somewhere, surprisingly. The New Age is a term that, I think it's become more and more dismissed in modern culture. Like, yeah. It's almost like considered, it's people use the term like woo-woo, right?
Yeah.
Or...
Yeah, New Age is almost derogatory.
It's almost derogatory. I mean, I think it probably is. I think it's fair to say, like, if someone says, oh, that's New Age, it just comes across pejorative. And that's a damn shame, in my view. Right. Obviously, I'm talking on the Spiritual Mystic podcast. But, basically what the New Age movement is, from a scholarly perspective, is a lot of things happened in kind of the early 1800s all the way into the end of the late 20th century, that several things kind of happened all at the same time very quickly that created this overemphasis on mystic, interior, intuitive inner research and, the contemplative tradition kind of reawakening post the Enlightenment, really. I mean, it was like the Enlightenment, scientific Enlightenment. What I say here in the article is religion kind of was reeling from this global shift towards rationalism and towards this scientific worldview. So what happened was really two things. some religious sects regressed into orthodoxy, like hardcore institutional customs and puritanical, you know, from the Amish to the Wahhabis. There's a many sects that went kind of amped up the fundamentalism mm-hmm. in response to the modern day scientific renaissance. And the other thing that happened is religion went more kind of spiritual and more mystical. And so that's what really these kind of new age like antecedents are. And I'm just going to run through them. We can just shout out really quickly, but basically the American Transcendentalist authors were huge in America. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Louisa May Alcott, Walt Whitman. They were influenced by Kant and German idealism, which was all about like the inherent purity of the individual, personal freedom. You know, the guidance of intuitive direction is like so, you know, Emersonian, like, which is Eastern influence. They had early translations of the Bhagavad Gita, and they had early translations of those Hindu texts and Buddhist texts and stuff. And so they were going, wait, you know, there's more to religion than just this kind of eternal damnation stuff. You know, it was getting away from that. Helena Blavatsky, Madame Blavatsky was the founder of the Theosophical Society. You might have heard of Theosophy. They very much, you can't really mention kind of history of mysticism without Blavatsky and the Theosophists. But they were really into Eastern stuff, and they kind of made their own organization, which is kind of a mystic misstep almost. Mm-hmm. And but they're very interesting, and they definitely did a lot of interfaith. Another word is called like syncretic or syncretistic, meaning like all are true kind of thing. They were the intellectual, the intelligentsia that were kind of early interfaith people. Annie Besant, Charles Ledbetter, and Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti is fascinating, who you might have heard of. He was a boy that they discovered, kind of like the Dalai Lama. Like they discovered Krishnamurti and they were like, he's the new Messiah. Like the early Theosophist was wild. But anyway, he eventually rejected that, and he became his own kind of institutionalist meditation teacher throughout the 20th century. So that's my tidbit on the Theosophists. They're very interesting. Phineas Quimby is the originator of the term New Thought. Can you guys hear this baby? Just edit notes. Are we good? Okay. Oh, good. All right. Because he's playing and he's very not self-aware.
sorry, keep going.
Hey, we're recording here, man. Phineas Quimby's New Thought, and then Mary Baker Eddy's Christian Science, which you might have heard of Christian Science before. It was all about the power of the mind and its role in spiritual healing. Mary Baker Eddy healed herself and other people started to heal themselves with their own mental capacity. That's an antecedent of like New Age. Talked about Carl Jung earlier, you know, the development of analytical psychology and like understanding the conscious mind, the subconscious, you know, layers of psyche contributed to this stuff. And Jung also studied mysticism and comparative mythology. Edgar Cayce was a guy who, he was a Christian mystic, but he would give psychic readings in the early 1900s. He talked about healing and reincarnation and all these kinds of ideas. You know, I think I need to write more about this, but 20th century physicists, we had talked about this, I think, in the metaphysical episode too, but a lot of like early quantum physics discoverers, I mean, even Einstein has some quotes that sound like pantheism. You know, they definitely had this like mystic thread among the early physicists. Mm-hmm. Max Planck and the consciousness as fundamental crowd, you know, I think contributed to New Age, Unitarianism, and that's Scott's, that's your domain. That's kind of what I think of UN school wise. Let's see, Unitarianism, I'm just like running through this really quickly because we're almost at the end, but Unitarianism was an early Christian denomination where they said, no, wait, actually, Jesus, he's a human being. You know, we're not born original sin. The Bible's infallibility isn't, you know, every word in the Bible isn't true. There's errors, and let's acknowledge that. So there was kind of some progressive Christian denominations emerging in the early 1800s, even in America, that is useful and important. A lot of religious academics also help to document and in some ways legitimize the esoteric. Max Müller was an early translator of Eastern sources. William James, who was this hugely influential Harvard psychologist and philosopher, who wrote a book called Varieties of Religious Experience. I think it's like 1910. That was important to proliferation of mystic philosophy and New Age. Evelyn Underhill, mentioned her earlier. George Gurdjieff, mentioned him. He was like this mysterious mystic philosopher in Europe. He influenced like intellectuals. And then also, you know, big, extreme shout out and extreme gratitude for the arrival of Hindu swamis and Buddhist teachers to America in the 1900s. You know, they started coming over. We talked a lot about Vivekananda and Yogananda, but there's so many more. There's a great book by Philip Goldberg called American Veda, and he basically describes, I think the subtitle is like From Emerson to the Beatles, like it's like how Eastern philosophy seeped into the American experience, and that was huge. But also Buddhist teachers, Suzuki set up the San Francisco Zen Center, Prabhavananda lived in California after Yogananda. We just started getting all these legitimate Eastern teachers in the 20th century. And then lastly, I think, you know, you got to mention the Beat authors, Jack Kerouac, Burroughs, Ginsberg, you know, these writers and poets in the 50s and 60s. And then, you know, counterculture, obviously, of psychedelic use being more commonplace and kind of Summer of Love and Leary and Ram Dass and Aldous Huxley and all those guys. You know, that all those things contributed to like quote unquote New Age spirituality and like this larger appreciation for ancient beliefs such as shamanism, Vedic Tantra, astrology, channel literature, and kind of like, you know, not quite institutional religion and not quite scientific materialist atheism. Like there's a lot of stuff in between. I mean, I think this is kind of my main big point here is like there's so much richness to all of these traditions and there's so much variation that like you know, I think a pretty dismissive take is like fairy tale mythology, like describing religion or spirituality is like, oh, those fairy tales are irrelevant, that stuff is ancient and now we have technology and science. And it's like that is like literally the thinnest reed of, you know, such a rich spectrum of, you know, esoteric scripture, ritual, contemplative practice, and, you know, psychological understanding and philosophical theology and ontology. You know, there's just a lot to kind of legitimize a further investigation of this stuff and a further kind of appreciation of these teachers and teachings. And, you know, you don't have got to read all of them. I just read a bunch of stuff there. So like there might be some overwhelm piling up and let me, you know, dismiss that. But, you know, it's kind of like if you relate to one or if you relate to any of those lines or books or teachers, like, check it out, you know, you know, try it for yourself. The experiential aspect, like, does it make you a better person? Does it generate, you know, happiness and bliss and, you know, undo aspects of your own limitation and your own obstacles? Because it might. I mean, it has in a way for me. I mean, you know, it's been a gradual journey. But it's been real, you know, it's definitely been tangibly effective in cultivating more higher states and more loving states for my fellow beings.
Well put.
Well, very well said. I was going to say, very well said.
My own testimony.
Yeah, even between the three of us, we've all found different we all resonate with different texts, you know, like I
totally
And mine are better than yours. You know, yours are lesser than mine, obviously, but...
Of course. No.
I'm just kidding.
He's kidding.
Yeah, no. And your own personality, you know? You're heavy into Vivekananda right now, Scott, because he's hitting on, like, secular and, like, rational kind of critical thinking concerns that, you know, maybe a Sufi poet might not do for you, you know? Mm-hmm. But you have... this kind of grounded, you know, intellectual force, which was Vivekananda, that you identify with and is bringing you benefit.
Sure, yeah, and I like love making connections with things he's saying with, you know, like Carl Jung and Max Planck, and then like Socrates. Like, there's threads that I'm tying between a lot of these people that there are more on the secular side, which I, you know, have like two scientists. Parents, and so like, and I find science fiction to actually be a wonderful way to convey all kinds of mystic beliefs as well, and it has been, and over the years, especially in the last few decades, it seems That's to cool. be a one of the sources. So yeah, that just happens to be the you know, the kinds of paths I've been following, but of course, you know, y'all have your own too, so there's plenty. It's almost like a shame that there's one term like new age for this like Cambrian explosion of like thought, you know. It's like, it's the same way that Hinduism is a misnomer, because we just put one name on like this like thousands year old like multifaceted thing, and it's like people have to have a term for stuff, I guess, but it's just you'll never hear me use the term new age, because it distracts more than it illuminates to me. So I try to find other ways to describe things.
Wow, yeah, even mysticism is a word that people like, because that's technically kind of what this is. Like, if you Wikipedia search mysticism, but like people think that means like magic, and like card stuff, you know. And it's like, no, like so that's kind of why I say mystic philosophy is a little less, I think, misunderstood. But even just the word mystic. I mean, to Melina's point earlier, it's so. Yeah. Culturally, it means something else than academically. Yeah. And so what's the right concepts? Well, I guess we're kind of trying to figure it out on the show, so, but
I don't know.
All words fail ultimately.
I love that you said that, Scott. So true.
The ineffable is the only one that...
And then like the only other thing I wanted to add was to your point, and I think it might be in your intro for the podcast about how there's many paths up the mountain, or something we talked about on the last episode, many paths up the mountain. And I think you just said that beautifully, or expressed that very clearly, Scott, and what you're interested in, what you resonate with, and your thoughts around New Age and everything you just said. It was super, super interesting to learn more of, because I think we do have different, we go through different paths leading up to the same thing. So I just thought that was really beautiful. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, of course. Thanks.
Totally. This is a great episode.
So great. I was just gonna say, Melina's your path has been like, meditation has been a huge part of your own soul transformation, which is
100%.
Maybe that's a whole nother episode.
Yeah, absolutely. it's interesting, because I do very much resonate with Zen. But again, to Scott's point, like, I'm very interested on what resonates with him and his perspective, and then what resonates, you know, so maybe that is.
And I need to tap into more of the meditative side, because I love the intellectual side of trying to pick apart these like kind of puzzles and like mine, you know, these all these sayings, all these Hindu sayings are so built to kind of break your rational mind. I think I've said that before on the podcast, and I love those exercises, because they force your brain to just think in entirely different ways. It's like a riddle almost that you gotta crack. But that's what I love. But I need to, you know, engage more in maybe what you usually do in the more meditative side of like get that thinking mind out of there and just like get into like a you know, a more Zen state where I'm not trying to think about it all.
Totally. And I was going to say, to your point, like that could, the meditative state, not necessarily that you need to, but I think you're, maybe you're more, you're feeling attracted and interested in it so that it can also help empower the intellectual and practical side of what the critical thinking that you are very drawn to. I think there's a beauty of having a little bit of everything kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. They interplay.
You know, because we're never going to know everything.
Right. Ain't that the truth?
So yeah. I'd like to think of them as like little affirmations almost of like. I'm so into comparative religion because, like, when I see the similarities, I'm just like, oh, like, and I think I've talked about this before. Like, I almost do that maybe to a fault, where I'm like, the Tao really is kind of different than the Holy Spirit. Like, I need to, you know, be a little firmer with my conceptual distinctions, probably. But also, again, conceptual form is ultimately pretty flimsy stuff.
And, yeah, it's still all form.
And even like the self-critical aspect of it, and like what you were saying, where you're like, I need to get into the, you know, I don't know, I'd be careful with that. I don't know if the mystic prescription is necessarily comes in with that kind of energy, so but your own self-awareness can do it.
Interested in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I shouldn't be worrying about it, I guess.
Much. It's like you're more getting more called to investigate it, which is really cool. And then to your point, Bob, like the comparative religion thing, I think it takes some people lifetimes to even accept the comparing of religion. You know what I mean? In that comparative aspect. So to your point, it's, you might feel so hard on, like, to a fault of your comparative religion understanding, but it, you know, I think there's just a balance in between both sides.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for that. I'll leave us with Baba Hari Harinanda, who said, many mask, one God. Many masks, one, you know, all this stuff is just different masks wearing of the one divine, you know, eternal presence, the ineffable within all beings. You know, just there's this multiplicity of phenomena that we get caught in. So may we all break it. Amen. Thanks, guys. Thanks for the long extended app. But useful traversing, hopefully. And we're going to have a great guest, actually. We'll be go out on a marketing plug. Heather Hawk-Feinberg is going to be our lovely children's mindfulness educator in 2 weeks. Oh, yeah, so it'll be really, really good. Excited. Awesome. Thanks, guys.
All right, thank you.
Yes. Be in touch. Thank you. Bye. Have a beautiful day. Bye.
Bye.